armor of the blood-mad chapter master Aracles, whose reign ended in such disaster for the chapter it had been struck from every record. The skull of the homunculus of Baal, a creature whose falsehoods almost brought the blood angels low. There were devices salvaged from dead worlds, dangerous technology that had survived the fall of old night, idols to alien gods, cracked force wands whose splinters allowed a direct view into other realities, cursed blades, the shattered bodies of Necron lords held prisoner in stasis, bolters that fired true every time but which required the blood of the innocent to function, the crowns of insane emperors, and the banners of fallen squads whose histories were blacker than the void. These and worse things were interred there. As Mephiston went past the galleries of cells, the sense of strangeness clinging to the place grew. The grinding thump of heavy machinery rumbled the brick, though there was no machinery there. Ghost lights flickered across distant passages, daring chase. Shadowy shapes blinked glowing eyes from inconstant corridors. At one junction, the thunder of a waterfall was carried on a cold draught that smelled enticingly of water, but if the sound were followed, both smell and sound petered out, and the explorer was confronted by a collapsed section of tunnel full of bones and black sand. Mephiston strode by all these wonders and horrors. None held any danger for the likes of him. The end of the corridor was where the Librarius ended, and whatever lay beyond it began. The sandy floor of the Carceri Arcanum stopped at an iron door, rough and purple with oxidization, but the warding symbols on it were clear to see for those with the right kind of sight. To Mephiston's eyes, they glowed. He rapped three times on the door with the head of his torch, causing it to sputter and shower sparks over the ground. With an unearthly moan, the door opened inward. Mephiston stepped through. His torch gutted out in a breeze rich with incense. It was so black that his sensitive eyes were blind. His warp sight was dulled by the counter runes painted on the walls. He saw only these, and then as a feeble glow. A machine coughed. There was the sound of a reactor powering up and the smell of exhaust. The machine noise became a grunting rumble. Pistons hissed. A vision sit glowed green in the dark, gradually lighting the room enough so that Mephiston might see the extent of the small antechamber. A second iron door was situated opposite the first, iron loops set in the frame crisscrossed with hexagrammatically warded chains. By the door, the square shape of a librarian dreadnought stood sentry. "Greetings, Mephiston, Lord of Death," a machine-moderated voice boomed out. "It is a long time since you visited my vault." The dreadnought occupied more than half the room. Its engines growled unevenly, rough with long inactivity. In one mechanical fist, the machine held an oversized power axe. The crystalline matrix was dormant, but the occupant of the dreadnought could bring it to life in a moment, and though ancient, employ it with devastating skill. "My Lord Marest," said Mephiston, "I have been fortunate that I have not needed to venture here for some time."
"What brings you to this most damned of places?" said the dreadnought. Marest was older even than Commander Dante. Once he had been the chief librarian, as Mephiston was now. Before he had been interred in the war tomb, he had commanded that a new vault be constructed where all the worst things in the chapter's care be kept, including the thing that had killed him. With his dying breath, Marest had pledged to watch over it for all time. And so he had. The room he now guarded was too small for his dreadnought to enter. When the vault of Marest had finally been finished, Marest's sarcophagus had been dragged in on a wooden sled, and his new body assembled around it. His dedication to the chapter was held up to the neophytes of each new generation. Every blood angel knew the story of Marest. "Have you come to view the scroll? Has the time come to seek new knowledge from our Lord's prophecies?"
"I am afraid not," said Mephiston. He dropped his extinguished torch and placed his hands on the hilt of Itaris. "I must go deeper."
"Is that so?" rumbled the dreadnought. what occurs in the world beyond.
Dark things, Lord Librarian. The great devourer approaches Baal, and another, older enemy.
You require knowledge, then, said Marest. You will visit the Octo Calvarii.
I shall. I am sorry to disturb it.
Why? Do you apologize because it was he who slew me, or because you fear my judgment on your actions?
Mephiston did not reply.
It matters not. Your position is a key that will unlock any door. You must do what you deem right, rumbled Marist. You are permitted to go where others are prevented. Nevertheless, I will provide the ritual warning. Be careful what dark things you look upon within this vault. Take none of their evil unknowingly out with you.
Your words are worth heeding, my Lord Marist.
They are, Lord of Death. Go with my blessing, said Marest.
His blocky upper body pivoted on the ball mount of the waist. He raised his force axe. Witchlight shone around the blade, and the chains fell from the doorway with a clatter.
And may the Emperor watch over your soul.
My thanks, Lord Marest. Before he left the room, Mephiston drew his sword. A chamber of marked contrast to Marest's atrium greeted him. A smooth cylinder of rockcrete dropped away down to a machine comprising an upright disc spinning round at ferocious speed, shooting out noisy blue sparks. Embossed steel skulls around the shaft's circumference stared up at him with bloodstone eyes. The cylinder was saturated with red light, the short bursts of electric blue mixing painfully into it. The limbless torsos of servitors were embedded in alcoves in the cylinder wall, level with the top of the disc. Lidless eyes held the disc in eternal vigilance. This unit accepted energy remotely broadcast from Idalia to power the vault's mechanisms, for unlike in the greater Undercroft, there were machines in the vault of Marest, special devices shielded from the odd effects of the Carceri Arcanum. Using the power of Idalia, they formed the random energies coursing the brick corridors and made of them strong psychic walls that none could penetrate. The vault of Marest was a prison above all else. Every part of its physical and metaphysical fabric was dedicated to the purpose of confinement. Dozens of fell things were kept inside. In the wider Carceri Arcanum were articles touched by chaos, but those inside the vault were wholly of it. They were things that could not be destroyed for fear of unleashing the evil they contained, or simply because they were not destructible in any understandable way. A catwalk ran around the circumference of the room. A single silver-plated door led out again, covered in warding signs. Mephiston went through this other door into the only pure chamber in the vault, and one of the largest, the Ecclesia Obscura. His footsteps echoed from distant walls, stained glass windows depicting scenes from Sanguinius's life, filtered light from an unknown source. No dust danced in the slanting beams, for the air was extremely scrubbed on its way in and out of the vaults by psychically active atmospheric filters. Whispers from the pallid scholiasts who inhabited the place murmured from the stones. This was the home of the Scrolls of Sanguinius. In the vault they were safe from all harm, psychic or physical. 15 scroll casings as big as men hung in stasis fields, their tops closed with wire crimped shut with lead seals. Mephiston paused by the casings, closing his eyes and allowing the sanctity of his long-dead lord bathe his soul. Something in him recoiled at the touch of Sanguinius's power, but he held his mind full in the fire, shuddering as it purified him. Nothing else of goodness was kept in the vault of Marest. The purity of the scrolls acted as a barrier to the evils that were housed in the deeper chambers. Scholiasts paused in their duties. Their minds touched Mephiston's own with feathered pressure. These men had been acolytum to the Librarius before their failure, but though rejected, they possessed some mental strength, and so they lived out their service in darkness, ministering to the relic of a hero whose glories they could never aspire to. Mephiston ignored the attention of these cast-offs and walked to the end of the hall. As he approached, An iron gate clanked into the ceiling. Stale air, tainted with a sharp scent of wickedness, blew at him. Gripping Vitaris more tightly, Mephiston proceeded into the inner vaults. Beyond the Ecclesia Obscura, the vaults took on the character of the Carceri Arcanum, becoming a warren of tunnels again, though these were of rock, crete, and silver rather than brick, and ribbed cables ran along the walls, carrying power to the locking mechanisms of the cells. The psychosphere was of a different sort to that of the Carceri Arcanum. It was trammelled by strange machines, and darker in flavour. Though securely held, the things jailed there leaked their malign influences into the fabric of the walls, making a dangerous cocktail for the soul. Mephiston felt its impurity saturate his being. He was unperturbed. There were darker things trapped inside his body. Doors hummed with caged warp power. Grey rock-crete gave way to warded adamantium and back again. Each room was specifically tailored to the evil of whatever it contained, bespoke creations that melded warp sorcery and science. Whole tunnels had been adapted as cells for the larger obscenities. Giant pits had been dug into the unearthly soil, lined with sanctified silver and roofed with bars of purest iron. Sanguinius's symbol was everywhere. Glass-fronted boxes projected hololithic symbols, anathema to the working of the warp. Combat servitors prowled the complex, their brain cases stamped with counterspells, the first line of defense should anything escape. Maintenance constructs trundled by, constantly monitoring for malfunction, ready to summon aid from the forge to fix what they could not repair themselves. Not everything there was an artifact. Some things had life, or a semblance of life, and were capable of action on their own. It was to one of these beings that Mephiston went. The vault was not particularly extensive. It took the Lord of Death only minutes to make his way to his destination, though time in the vault was difficult to accurately measure. He turned off the main corridor and came to a crude-looking cell door of black wood with a steel grille rusted orange at eye level. Its appearance was deceptive. Inside the tree the wood was harvested from, veins of psychically conductive crystal had been force-grown, and they vibrated with the power of the Empyrean. Mephiston looked in. A dark shape sat at the center of the room, four arms stretched out from an emaciated body and held in place by manacles and chains engraved with complex circuitries. The floor thrummed with the action of hidden machinery. There was no key. No normal lock would hold the prisoner. Mephiston pushed upon the wood. His skin tingled through his armor. Without his ceramite, the power running through it would have burnt his flesh. The door creaked open. With a gesture, Mephiston ignited four rod lumens stapled to the wall. Three shone with a cold greenish light, the fourth hitched and buzzed with a flicker that would not settle. The creature in the cell was not human. Two stumpy legs made up its numbers of limbs to six. Its skin was slack, on fatless flesh, many ribs clearly visible beneath. The Octo Calvarii had been in the cell for 3,000 years without any nourishment. It should have died long, long ago, but it would not. The thing lifted its head. Whether its body was its true form was not known. There had been none of its race left to compare it with. But its face was not its original. Chaos had had its way with the thing's features, perverting them in a manner that was unmistakable. Upon its alien head, 8 tiny grotesque faces had grown. They were all identical, perhaps miniature replicas of the Xenos's original. There were 6 simple eyes on each. The noses were 3 gill-like vertical slits. The mouths were slender proboscises, curled neatly between poisonous palpae. The creature did not use speech like men did. It was probably its species had been psychic. If so, it was their downfall. Traces of larger features were visible as puckers in the smooth flesh. Chaos had wiped the Xenos's face clean, giving it 8 in miniature in cruel recompense. Mephiston felt its intellect prodding at his. With a thought, he pushed aside the empiric veils caging its mind, making an aperture big enough for it to speak through. "Who are you?" it said. Its thoughts were alien. There was no linguistic structure that a human would recognize, but Mephiston understood, psyker to psyker. I am Mephiston, chief librarian of the Blood Angels, the Lord of Death, said Mephiston aloud.
A fitting name for one such as you.
Its multiple eyes blinked together.
You are the successor to the one who killed my followers and caged me.
I am, many generations removed. You have been here a long time. The thing let its head droop.
For preaching the truth of reality to your people, you kill and enslave.
It said,
You call me monster, you who hunger for the blood of your own kind.
You are the enslaver, said Mephiston. By warpcraft, you subjugated 3 imperial systems and seduced their inhabitants away from the light of the Emperor and damned them for all eternity. Your confinement here is just. We would kill you if we could. The alien's smooth flesh convulsed, the 8 tiny faces pulsed, their eyes closing and opening in rhythmic waves. A show of mirth. Its laughter echoed in Mephiston's mind.
You cannot. The Dark Lords make me strong. Have you come here to gloat? If you have, enjoy it. I shall one day be free of this place. I will be merciful to those who show me respect.
I have no need to gloat, said Mephiston, and you shall never escape. I have come instead to seek your wisdom, evil as it is. The thing laughed again. Its suspended body quivered.
That is amusing.
A great darkness approaches Baal.
I see it. A blankness in the sea of souls. An unending hunger comes. It desires to consume you. Your hungers are similar. Do you not see it as a kindred spirit?
Asked the being. Mephiston ignored the alien's insinuation. There is something else. Another event is soon to occur, not of the material realm, but of the warp. I have seen it in a vision, but will have confirmation before I act. The thing dragged its deformed head upright.
And you want me to help you?
It laughed again, its amusement buffeting Mephiston's stony soul.
You will help me. Then release me, it said, and perhaps I may accommodate your desires before I kill you.
I never said I needed your active participation. Mephiston drove Vitaris into the ground before the alien psyker and reached out his hands towards it. Red fire flickered around his fingers. He bent the creature's mind to his will, but it fought him all the way, and for a moment Mephiston feared he had attempted a task he could not accomplish, and that the being would overwhelm him. With a psychic shout, he pushed hard, battering the Octocalvarii into submission. The creature was a worshipper of chaos in its formless glory, and was many thousands of years old. Who knew what worlds it had ruined, or how many species it had corrupted? At the height of its power, it had been a prophet of incredible accuracy. Its link to the Empyrean was still strong, and Mephiston rode this as a warrior from a backward world might attempt to master an unbroken steed. The Xenos's mind bucked and thrashed in his psychic grip, but he did not relent. And through the creature's many unholy eyes, he looked out into the realm of chaos and the myriad possibilities forming there. A billion horrible images burned into his second sight. He sifted through them quickly. Carbander's lust for the souls of the Blood Angels shone redly bright. Mephiston homed in on the greater demon's essence with little difficulty. For a brief moment, he saw the demonic battle still raging. The Red Angel burned with furious fires. Carbander was within a spear's cast of the gate. He was coming to the material realm. The bloodthirster paused in its carnage, turned, and looked Mephiston directly in the eye. Carbander's bellow sent the Lord of Death flying backwards. Trailing flames, he slammed into the wall of the Octocalvarii's cell. The Octocalvarii convulsed in its chains, setting them rattling violently. When the spasm stopped, it hung from its bonds, laughing more loudly than ever.
That is what you wanted to know. Had you told me, I would have shown you willingly. There is no finer thing than presenting a being with truth of its own death. The never-born you call Carbander will come for you, so-called Lord of Death. He will take your mortal skull for his drinking cup, and your soul shall join his armies and throw down this Imperium you pretend to love.
Mephiston recovered himself and took up Vitaris.
Those are lies, he said calmly. Are they? You will see.
said the Octocalvarii. There is a darkness in you that eclipses my own, Lord of Death. Let me free, so I may see you fall.
You will remain here, said Mephiston, his voice cold as the depths of space. Be assured, if it were possible, I would slay you.
One day you will be my ally, said the Octocalvarii.
Never, said Mephiston.
He severed the psychic link, leaving the Octocalvarii scratching at the walls of his mental fortress. For an instant, Mephiston considered running the Xenos sorcerer through, simply for the pleasure of hurting it. He sheathed Vitaris and departed. Chapter 9. Dante's Dilemma. The Red Council was one of the Blood Angel's two ruling bodies, the other being the Council of Blood and Bone. The latter was made up of the senior chaplaincy and sanguinary priesthood, responsible for the spiritual and physical work to constrain the floor. Chief among their duties was the selection of a new chapter master when the office was vacant. The Red Council's purview was the waging of war, and as that was the purpose of all Adeptus Astartes chapters, it was the senior of the two groups. Such was the importance of the Red Council that the room where it met in the Arx Angelicum was replicated in every detail upon both battle barges of the chapter, the Blade of Vengeance and the Blood Caller. At least, so it had been. When responses from the successor chapters began flooding into the Fortress Monastery, Dante had decreed that the council room be expanded so that all the chapter masters and their captains might sit there as brothers. "This is our darkest hour, and they have answered," he had told his assembled officers. "I will accord them the honor as if they were of our own chapter," he said. "Let no warrior come to Baal at our call for assistance and feel himself less than equal." The ancient room was obliterated. 6,000 years of history was made dust in the effort of a week. Many other halls were carved away to make space for Dante's vision. The number of seats on the Red Council was 25. The rebuilt chamber of the Red Council was 20 times as large. 500 seats were arrayed around a massive circular table with a hollow center. The chapter master's chair had been slightly larger than the others to emphasize his status as first among equals. Dante insisted his chair in the new chamber be replaced in the room exactly the same as it had been before, and that the chairs for the other chapter masters be the same size as his. The new table was of pure white marble. The names and ranks of those invited to attend were displayed on adaptive golden plaques set into the table's surface. The plaques were the same in dimension and decoration. No warrior would think another more highly regarded than any other. The chamber of the Great Red Council was as artful and fine as everything the Blood Angels made. Its decoration was flawless, a display of taste and craftsmanship of the highest sort. Black rock was polished until it gleamed. Reliefs of every single successor chapter the Blood Angels had begotten decorated the walls, their heraldry picked out in bright minerals and precious metals. Those who were damned were included, though their panels covered over with black cloth. Those who were lost to war were marked with glowering collections of skulls, carved from the same ivory as the Blood Angels' sarcophagi. All the chapters that sprang from Sanguinius's glory were there, alive and dead, good and bad alike. The worst of them had been heroes once, and the shame of their falling was a lesson the others should not neglect. Scrolls carved in the stone bore the names of every chapter master of these orders, at least so far as they were known. The names of prominent heroes were embroidered upon flags hanging over the shrines, and parchments fixed with coloured waxes recorded the most famous battle honours of each brotherhood. The founding lords of the second generation chapters were commemorated in stone. To make them, the bones of the extinct volcano had been shaped into living marvels, statues so realistic they looked as if they might step down from their plinths. Even those races who considered themselves more refined than gross humanity would have marvelled at the chamber's beauty. There was a weight of history, of honour, and of justified pride, and so the room felt as old as the chapter, though it had been finished only a few days before. It waited for those who would fill it, ready to judge the deeds of the living against those of the dead commemorated on the walls. It was in this great chamber of the Red Council that Mephiston met with Dante. The Lord of Death arrived to find his lord sitting in his throne. His helm was set on the table, Dante gazing intently at the outraged face of Sanguinius, as if it would speak with the Primarch's wisdom. Mephiston's footsteps echoed lightly as he crossed the floor. The Lord of Death moved stealthily always, like the predator he was. Fire bowls and candles lit the space, casting its crannies into red darkness. Dante was a being of liquid flame in his gold. The candlelight moved on his armor, inviting the chapter master to join it in dances of destruction. The movement was false. Dante remained still, lost in thought, until Mephiston stopped before him.
"I have come," said Mephiston.
Dante looked up, his ancient face hollowed with worry. "You will tell me now what you could not before." Mephiston nodded once, a slight incline of his head. It was as if a statue had moved, a slight motion caught out of the corner of the eye, so mundane a gesture, yet terrifying when performed by the Lord of Death.
"There was another part of my initial vision, my lord. I went into a hellish kingdom of fire, bone, and blood. There I saw Carbander."
The fires in the room guttered and flared, dancing a little harder at the mention of that name. Dante narrowed his eyes sharply.
"You are sure it was the Angel's Bane?"
"Yes, my lord."
"And what was he doing?"
"He was fighting his way through a legion of black-skinned demons."
"Is it not the way of the Blood God's minions to always make war on one another?"
"It is," said Mephiston, "if the Dark Lord is to be believed."
"Then what of it?"
"He was fighting his way out. A vision of a red angel burned in the sky. There was a gap in the world, a rift, beneath the angel that opened upon our universe."
"You think he means to come here?" said Dante.
"I do."
"But you are not sure of the vision's veracity."
"No, my lord, I was not," said Mephiston. "That is why I delayed."
"I have seen nothing of the Angel's Bane in any of my own visions," said Dante.
He lapsed into thought for a moment.
"You say you are not certain. I take it you are now."
"Yes," said Mephiston. "It was he. He is coming. I have confirmed it."
Dante peered more closely at his chief librarian, noting perhaps the greyness to his alabaster skin brought on by the strain of his visit to the Octa Calvarii that made him more like a corpse than ever.
"Do I wish to know how this was done?" asked Dante.
"I think not, my lord," said Mephiston.
And in truth, he had little appetite for recounting his journey into the vaults of Marist.
"It was hard, and it cost me. But it was a worthwhile endeavor, I am sure. The Angel's Bane means to attack us while all the chapters of the blood are gathered. This is a truth."
"Can he return?" asked Dante.
"He was not long banished from the material realm."
"There are rules even for the servants of chaos," said Mephiston. "The vision of my librarians is occluded, and we go blinder every day. But I can say that beyond the shadow in the warp, all is changing. There is an unprecedented flux. I cannot see past the darkness the hive mind casts, but all reality holds its breath. The Empyrean is pregnant with portents. If Abaddon's black crusade affects the Eye of Terror as my vision suggested, Carbander may make his way through."
Dante smiled humorlessly.
"He attacks when we are at our strongest, and yet when we are gathered together, we are also at our weakest."
"The gathering of all the sons of Sanguinius for the first time in generations is too tempting for him. We know that the Blood God covets us. Our rage draws the servants of the Skull Throne to us as surely as flies to corpses. If Carbander comes, it could be disastrous. He is the lure to the thirst, the catalyst to madness. If he manifests while we are engaged in the defense of Baal, we shall be at our most wrathful, our most unrestrained. We will fall."
"It says in your archives, does it not, that the servants of the Blood God have tried, and they have failed many times, to sway us? Need these monsters be reminded that there are many kinds of rage, and there is nobility in overcoming them?" said Dante.
"We must resist every single time. He needs to succeed only once," said Mephiston. The never-born have eternity. We do not. And not every chapter of the blood has as much restraint as ours.
Dante was troubled. Do not bring your enmity with Seth into this, he said.
I have no enmity against him. I have no enmity against anyone. His enmity is for me. I feel nothing for him. I speak the truth, my lord, and you know it.
Dante shifted in his chair, his armor scraped on stone, its motive units whining. Can the angel's bane be stopped?
I honestly do not know, said Mephiston. I can try. There are certain rituals that may be attempted.
They are dark in nature, said Dante.
Of course, said Mephiston.
Dante's expression clouded. Another decision for the chapter master to wrestle with, always a choice between two evils. If Mephiston had been closer to humanity, he would have felt sympathy for his lord. For 1,500 years, Dante had watched their bloodline descend further into savagery and the Imperium draw nearer to its end. To all others, he was a golden angel, the avatar of the Emperor's most noble Primarch. His legend was known the length and breadth of the galaxy. His advice was sought by all, and his warriors clamored for on every battlefront. Nobody knew of the despair behind the mask. So though Mephiston could not feel pity or sorrow for Commander Dante, he remembered despair, and he understood the dilemmas that faced his leader.
What is your counsel, Chief of the Librarius? Asked Dante eventually.
I would attempt to stop him, said Mephiston. I will do so only if you decree it shall be so.
Then I order you to stop him, said Dante.
No matter the cost.
Dante's lips thinned. No matter the cost. Mephiston bowed in a rustle of silks and purring armor joints.
Then it shall be done, my lord.
Dante stood. Mephiston, tell no one of this that does not need to know. Bind your librarians by oath not to reveal what you will attempt. If you recruit from the other chapters, make them swear the same. Dante stared angrily into the face of Sanguinius. This war breeds secrets too readily. Chapter 10. The Great Red Council. The chapters of the blood waited for Dante on their feet, as respect demanded. 500 exalted heroes of the Imperium filled the chamber of the Great Red Council. The oils and exhausts of their power armor blended with the incense pouring from the firebowls, adding to it a sacred machine scent. So the host was gathered. The sons of Sanguinius, the most noble of all the Adeptus Astartes, and the most troubled. Garbed in battle plate of black and red, white and gold, a diversity of livery that could not hide their unity of blood. Fire's warm illumination brought their appearances closer. It muted the gold, enlivened the black, tinted the white, so their armor did not appear so different. Blood swords stood by angels numinous. Charnel guard and red wings waited with exsanguinators. The savages of the Carmine Blades rubbed elbows with warrior scholars of the Golden Suns. Those who had embraced the flaw met the counterparts who defied it to the point of destructive denial. If divided by custom, they were united by blood. Time had wrought its changes on their temperament and traditions, but underneath the varied colors of their skin and their tattoos, beneath their esoteric rites, they were the same. The Scions of Sanguinius had come home. The blood thralls of their hosts waited on them, serving spiced wines adulterated with vitae. Other refreshments were available, from plates of exquisitely prepared food to ritual bleedings, and the blessings of chaplains were given out to troubled souls wishing for some of the grace of the Primarch. They spoke to one another in hushed tones. A space marine must strive heroically to become intoxicated, but if it was in the character of some of those present to try, none did so. Though Brother Anicio had thrown open the doors of the chapter's wine cellars, and there was enough drink to make raucous feast. Restraint reigned. For all the pageantry of the gathering, it was funereal, a family gathering precipitated by tragedy. Warriors from the chapters, who were virtually unknown to one another, conversed, amazed at their differences, united by their similarities. The talk turned inexorably, in every meeting, to the impending arrival of the Leviathan and the impossible task ahead. A trumpet sang with heavenly notes so refined, all paused to hear it. Not a single voice continued, not from the most cynical, nor from the most aggressive. Fire crackled in the sudden quiet. A choir of angelic voices swelled over the main entrance from the mouths of the statues standing guard there, and silence was banished again. An ancient blood thrall, high-ranked in the logisticium, came into the hollow center of the great white table upon a mechanized platform. His natural limbs were withered, so for support he was strapped upright into the legged carriage. 7 metal legs tapped and scraped on the stone, carrying him when his own legs could not. A flock of miniature cyber angels passed and swooped overhead, adding their tiny voices to the chorus emanating from the statues by the door. The thrall held up a corpse-like hand. Telescopic eyes extended and whirred as they performed a semblance of blinking. The man's body was wrecked with age, but his voice was clear and pure, preserved by his masters for its beauty. "Take your places, lords of the blood." He spoke without music, and yet his voice was so fine it sounded like singing. "Lord Dante comes, commander of Baal, master of the blood angels, keeper of the blood, lord of the angelic host. Dante, lord of angels, Dante, lord of Baal, Dante, lord of the firstborn sons," sang the chorus of cybernetic angels. "Dante, Dante, Dante." Melodies, perfect in their complexity, accompanied the exaltation of the commander's titles, while a dulcet chant of his many victories played counterpoint. The doors flew open. In strode a procession of the highest and the best the blood angels had to offer. The exalted herald of Sanguinius, leader of the sanguinary guard, Brother Sepharon, led the way. "Dante is here! All stand for Commander Dante!" he shouted, though all in the room were standing already. Behind Sepharon marched the 15 sanguinary guard presently on Baal. In their footsteps followed the company captains. 6 were present, for 4 were at Diamore in battle against the black fleets of Abaddon. Machiavi of the 3rd, Castigon of the 4th, Raxietel of the 6th, Zedrinal of the 8th, Sendroth of the 9th, and final Borgio of the 10th, the master of recruits. The fleet captains were next, led by Asante, captain of the battle barge Blade of Vengeance, walking side by side with Asimuth of the Blood Caller. Then came the chapter ancient Belmore, carrying the colors of the Blood Angels proudly before him, a sacred relic depicting Sanguinius. The cloth of the banner had not faded since its weaving thousands of years in the past. Only after Belmore and this honor guard of noble heroes did Commander Dante himself arrive. To his right was Brother Corbulo, bearing the red grail itself, the very vessel that had caught the dying Sanguinius's blood. On his left was Chaplain Ordermail, Paternus Sanguis, second only to Astoreth the Grim in the Order of the Reclusium, carrying Amit's reliquary out of the Basilica Sanguinarum, wherein the last feather of the Primarch was kept in permanent stasis. Behind him walked Mephiston, Lord of Death, Chief of Librarians, and Incariel, Master of the Blade, huge in his Martian's priest's battle gear, then Brother Bellerophon, Keeper of the Heaven Gate, the Blood Angel's fleet commander, and at his side Brother Adanisio, Master of the Logisticium. In Adanisio's train were the leaders of the chapter's human servants from every division, scholiasts of the Librarius, equerries to the chapter councils, Logisticium adepts, the captain ordinary of the Blood Thrall Warriors, Master Leta of the Astropaths, and those navigators who could bear the gravity of Baal. Finally, there were champions of each of the companies at that date on Baal, all clad in armor of the most ancient sort. These suits had seen service in the Horus Heresy, and were lovingly decorated. The name of the warrior who had worn the armor those many thousands of years ago was emblazoned upon their chest plates and helms. The armor waited for days like this, guarded against decay by arcane sciences. Today it was worn again in remembrance of who the Blood Angels once were, and the weapons of legendary heroes were clasped in the hands of the champions also. After them, servitors shepherded velvet-padded grav sleds bearing other relics. The sword, Valor's Edge, the plasma pistol, Fury of Baal, Galleon's staff, the Angel's Wing, the Crown Angelic sitting easy upon a polished skull, And then, the Veritas Vitae, the machine blessed enough to record the words of Sanguinius himself, then repeat them upon the field of battle. A column of armed blood thralls, 20 strong, their small human forms lost in ornate half-powered carapace suits, followed their masters in their storied battle-plate and the relics in their train. Behind them walked a mighty librarian dreadnought, decked with honors and 4 more of his kind. Lastly were robed blood thralls bearing golden censers, spilling the most wonderfully fragrant smoke, and 5 thralls in black bearing representations of the 5 virtues, and 5 in white bearing similar gold objects depicting the 5 graces. All about the procession was heavenly singing and glory, and they walked into the chamber of the Great Red Council in a blaze of golden light. At the table, the procession peeled apart, one stream heading to the right, the other to the left. Those blood angels granted seats at the table stood behind their appointed places, while the rest went to stations around the hall. The champions and sanguinary guard went to recesses in the walls to watch over the gathering, while the warrior thralls turned and stamped their feet, forming an avenue for their baseline human brothers to negotiate before they too went to their duties about the hall, whether to serve, advise, or to burn their holy smokes by the effigies of celebrated heroes. The chapter lords of the blood watched in respectful quiet as the mightiest of their number went to stand at his place at the table. The artifacts his comrades carried, the blood, the feather, the standard, the ancient armors, were of the most sacred kind to all the chapters of the blood, but it was Dante's gleaming golden presence that held all their attention. Over Dante's face was the death mask of Sanguinius, the righteous anger of their lord father frozen in gold, and his blood preserved in the bloodstone upon Dante's forehead. These were more than symbols the blood angels brought. They were tangible links to the past and the chapter's shared origins. Corbulo handed off the grail to a thrall of the Sanguis Corpusculum. Ordemail gave Amit's reliquary to a black-robed, tongueless servant of the Reclusium Citadel. As these human serfs stood behind their masters, so did Brother Balemore stand behind Dante's chair. The flag silk rippled liquidly. The music ceased. True silence fell again. The brothers of a score of chapters remained standing as Dante surveyed his allies with Sanguinius's unblinking, shining eyes. "My brothers," said Dante, his pronouncement startling in the sepulchral quiet, "these artifacts that my warriors and their servants bear date back to the time of Horus's great betrayal of our beloved emperor. These relics here, these suits of armor, these weapons my brothers carry, date from the most terrible war in our history. And these," he pointed to the red grail and to Amit's reliquary, "they bore witness to our lord's death, for both are vessels for his mortal remains. No greater shock have the chapters of the blood experienced than when our lord fell to the blades of his hateful brother, not when our forebears were sundered from one another's company, not in those times when our chapters have faced annihilation, as my own has, 3 times within the span of my life. Sanguinius's loss echoes to this day in all of us. It is a pain that is immortal. Yet those times passed, no matter how dark they appeared. Through the sacrifice of our Lord, the Emperor was triumphant, and order was restored. From this, I draw hope." He paused. No one spoke. "I have lived a long time. I have seen things I thought never to see. Every century I survive presents a new horror to test our Imperium. I have seen the Necrons awaken. I have witnessed the Tau emerge. I was there when the High Fleets first came out of the intergalactic void to prey upon the worlds of our species. I have fought Ghazkull, the great beast of the Orcs, upon the thrice-damned world of Armageddon. I have seen chapters fall. I have seen worlds die. I have seen the flower of the Imperium's martial might laid low by the perfidy of traitors. I have seen the ambition of vain men deliver the innocent into the obscene hungers of the endless dark." The glowing eyes of Sanguinius's mask swept over the crowd of warriors. "I have seen all this. I have faced every manner of enemy, and I have slain them all," he said, his voice rising. "The Imperium stands. We are the angels of death, the Emperor's appointed champions. We are the lords of battle, the bringers of vengeance. We are the sons of Sanguinius, the red line of blood which none shall pass. He placed his hands on the table and leaned forward. What is to come will test you. You will look to the sky in search of the stars, and you will not see them. The Tyranid swarms will block out their light. You will marvel at the number of creatures they shall land upon these worlds, and you will doubt it shall ever end. You shall speak with your psychers and your librarians, and they will tell you of the shadow that blinds and pains all those who look into the warp. You shall see all this, and you shall believe that we cannot prevail. But I tell you this, prevail we shall, he shouted. By blade, bolt, plasma, and las beam, we shall cut them down. By the strength of our blood will we throw them back. We shall make a virtue of our curse, and release the unbounded savagery of Sanguinius upon these trespassers. We will do this because it must be done. We will do this because there are no others to do it. High Fleet Leviathan comes against us with a great portion of its strength. If these worlds of Baal fall, the whole of Ultima Segmentum will be open to its swarms. The high fleets will pour north, devouring everything in their path, and the Imperium will be dealt a grievous blow. He slammed his fists down onto the perfect new marble of the table, cracking its surface. This shall not be so! This will be a victory where there have been only defeats. Here on Baal, the Leviathan shall die! His shout resounded around the chamber. He drew in a deep, ragged breath. His fury affected all those near to him, and as their thirst awoke, it provoked that in others further still. And so the red rage of Sanguinius radiated out from Commander Dante like slow ripples in a pool of blood, until all felt its touch, and the urge to do battle grew keen in the twin hearts of the warriors in the hall. The Imperium will endure, growled Dante. By the blood of Sanguinius that I bear upon my brow and that I carry in my veins, I swear it shall be so. He sat heavily. Silence held for a moment and broke suddenly. Dante! Screamed someone. His cry was taken up. Dante! 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 The Space Marines shouted, raw and raging, so very different to the pure angelic singing that had ushered the commander in. Dante! 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 They roared. They each beat one fist upon their chest plates, filling the chamber with a raucous clash of metal. Dante! 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 There were warriors in the hall who felt their rage burn hot and crimson and struggled to contain themselves, so great was the outpouring of emotion in that place. Dante held up a hand. Balemore slammed down the staff of the chapter banner. The sharp crack of metal on stone broke through the applause like a stone through ice. I pray for your indulgence a little while longer, said Dante. Quiet returned. And I bid you sit. A strange chorus sang, the whine and scrape of 500 suits of power armor lowered into 500 stone chairs. Firstly, I thank you all for responding to our call for aid in this darkest hour. Dante said. Loyalty to Sanguinius's home is admirable, but not demanded of our bloodline. I am gratified and humbled by the numbers you and yours have brought to the defense of this system. Never since the breaking of the legions have so many of our kind been present in one place at one time. He looked around the room gravely. However, the scale of this angelic host brings its own problems. Every one of us in this room is a lord among angels. We are the masters of the chapters of the blood. Each one of us bears great responsibilities, be it for 100 men, a fleet, or a system of worlds. We are equals, you lords of blood and I, and so there is a matter that must be settled, a question that must be asked. He paused. The words were important. They must be put well. The question I would ask of you is one of command, said Dante. You may think that I would take the lead without your explicit approval. I would never presume to do so. I ask instead that you permit me to lead the defense of Baal and in any military action that might be required to break the High Fleet thereafter. that you submit your warriors and yourselves to my command alone, and that you shall swear to do my bidding no matter the cost, or how much you may disagree with my course of action. Quiet again. A warrior in black and gold stood from his chair. A swift-moving servo-skull went to hover over his head, bathing him in a soft, lumen glow. "Captain Cantor of the Golden Suns," it said, "Keeper of the Wheel, Slayer of Dan Rain of the 15th Path, Blood Lord of Cathoy, Exterminator of the Skarl." Cantor let the herald skull say its piece. In the light, the skin of his bare head was a deep nut-brown of lustrous hue, and his hair was tightly plaited and gathered into a short braid at the back. Golden tattoos glimmered in the light.
"I am but a second captain. No master am I," he said. "I was sent here with my own warriors and two half-companies of my brother captains at the command of my chapter master, Erden Cleave. He gave me express orders to follow your will to the letter. You need not ask if we shall follow you, Commander Dante."
He banged his fist upon his chest, then made the sign of the Aquila.
"I hear at Armageddon the generals of the Imperium appointed you as Lord Commander, but they debated first. There is no need for that here. You are among your kin. You are our lord."
He bowed his head and sat. A cheer went up around the room.
"My thanks for your words, brother," said Dante. "But there will be warriors here who perhaps think they should have ultimate say in the deployment of their chapters, as is only right. I believe that only in unity shall we prevail. I cannot proceed until I am assured that my orders will be obeyed by all. Our lives, our victory depend upon it."
Another warrior stood, this one helmed and in party-colored armor of black and red. The herald skull's light lit gorgeously worked trim. Upon his shoulder, a winged skull glared out imperiously.
"Castellan Zargo, chapter master of the Angels in Carmine, Fleet Lord, Far Wanderer, master of the Gloried Reach."
"We of the Angels in Carmine commit ourselves wholly to your cause."
Through his helm emitter, his voice was hard and rasping.
"I am sure there are many more here who would agree. I feel I can vouch for the sentiments of chapter master Seth. Though we have had our differences, I am sure we are of mind on this matter. Chapter Master Glorian and Chapter Master Wojtek, among others also. Is there need for this, Dante? You are the great hero of the Imperium. Your name and exploits are known to all of us, even those who have never been within 1,000 light-years of Baal before." "Aye, aye," men shouted. "It is true."
"Let us be about this war without this charade. You bear the blood of Sanguinius on your forehead," said a warrior in somber gray.
"Paracelius, first captain, charnel guard, giver of the bones, 19th of the title," said the skull.
"You wear Sanguinius's mask on your face. We shall all follow you," Paracelius said.
"Yet I am not Sanguinius," said Dante. "You all must understand this. I have achieved much, but my legend is different to my story. I am only a warrior like you. Know this. Know also that this war may be the doom of your chapters. I will command only by consent, and not by some supposed right. For who but the Emperor could confer that on me? Therefore, in his absence, I must ask my peers for their approval." "So we will die," shouted a captain of the blood swords, surging to his feet too quickly for the herald to reach him and call out his name. "What of it? For what other reason did the Emperor create us than to die in battle performing service to him? If our deaths will aid victory, then so be it. Life is fleeting. The blood is eternal. We fight not for ourselves, but for our gene line and the Imperium." "Hear, hear," shouted several warriors. Gauntlets banged thunderously on the table.
"Dante shall lead us," cried someone.
"Dante! Dante!"
Dante stilled the noise with a raised hand.
"If you are so eager for me to command you, then heed this first order," said Dante. "Vote."
"Aye. Very well. We shall vote,"
shouted a helmetless chapter master in rich white and red armor.
"Lord Volodark, chapter master of the Angels Excelsis, the Void Sword, master of Utrecht,"
said the skull herald.
and I shall swear to be bound by your command should my brothers in arms here vote yes.
Volodark shouted. His eyes were wild and bloodshot. Spittle flew from his lips. He held up his hands and turned around so that all could see him.
But, he said, his voice dropping, should the vote prove against you, Lord of the Hosts, then I shall command my own men in the manner of my choosing, and that will be to follow you.
Dante inclined his head in acknowledgement. All I ask is that you vote. The vote will be done simply and quickly. When my master of ceremony asks that you cast your lots, stand if you favor my command of this defense, and subsequent actions necessary to break Leviathan. Remain seated if you wish to operate independently. I remind you that all of you in here are bound to honor the outcome, no matter your preference. The warriors spoke with each other then, either for or against. The motion of impassioned gestures made drafts in the room that stirred the fires lighting the gathering. Dante nodded to his master of ceremony. The old man piloted his conveyance into the center of the table, the thick metal cables running down his back, linking his brain with its motive systems, gleaming orange gold.
My lords, he said in his incongruously beautiful voice, we ask you to be silent. We shall now vote on the matter, the first to be put to the great red council of the angelic host.
Conversation dropped away reluctantly. Warriors who had stood sat again so as not to preempt the result.
Vote, called the master of ceremony.
The hall reverberated to the sound of hundreds of armored giants getting to their feet. The growl and whine of armor joints working in unison filled the space so that it sounded like a mechanical dragon stirring in its lair. Servo skulls swept over the silent crowd. From the ceiling, a robotic angel descended, lowered by an armature. It spread useless metal wings. Red light burned fiercely in its soulless metal face. Fine laser spread scanned up and down the voting space marines as the angel turned in a slow circle. There were a handful of warriors who remained defiantly seated, and of them only two were chapter masters. Commander Dante's reputation was such that very few of them would not follow him. The majority in the room were variously surprised and annoyed that he asked at all. Most of the captains that remained seated did so on principle to honor the Codex Astartes commandment that no lord, no matter how great, should command more than 1,000 space marines. Only a couple were arrogant enough to believe they could do better than the master of the Blood Angels. The angel finished his count, its metal eyes shut with a click, and its wings folded. The master of ceremony closed his eyes, communing via data pulse with the machineries of the Arx Angelicum.
In favor of Commander Dante commanding the defense of Baal, 476. Against, 24.
Deafening cheers and applause ripped through the chamber. Dante stood and shouted into the tumult.
Then it is decided. I shall command you as if you were my own until this conflict is done and Baal is saved. Until that time, I will treat you with the honor and respect I accord my own warriors, and mete out the same punishments to those who defy my will. Any who do not agree may leave. This is your last chance. Go without rancor, and be counted among our brothers still.
The applause petered out. Dante's glowing eyes lit upon the last seated warriors. Not one of them moved.
Very well, said Dante with a curt nod. To war! So it shall be, cried out a captain of the blood drinkers. Dante, Dante, Dante!
The shout began again. Once more the ancient heart of the Arx Angelicum rocked to the shouted name of its master.
Enough, commanded Dante, and all fell silent. We shall turn now to the matter at hand. The destruction of High Fleet Leviathan.
A hololith activated, adding its gentle thrum to the room's noises. Ribbon projectors concealed in carved angels upon the ceiling painted a glowing star map whose sides brushed the edges of the table's interior. A section of the Ultima Segmentum floated in space, perfect in every detail. Across its center was the broad, bloody brushstroke of the red scar. Baelor glowed off-center. The twin-starred Cryptus system burned to the galactic southwest. There were many stars in the sky, and all were red, whether they were lone wanderers in the red wilderness or tightly packed in the stellar nurseries that cramped the southern obscura veil. The cartolith showed space around the scar too, and away from the lurid glow the norms of space reasserted themselves. The scar was relatively sparsely inhabited, but outside the scar were millions of systems, hundreds of them imperial, all at risk. Once established, the illusion of space was total. For a few seconds, the chapters of the blood were warrior gods peering down from their celestial palace at the mortal realm. A flicker and an influx of data banished the effect. Signifiers and data screed sprang up all over the map. First came the system names, unrolling themselves in multitudes over the points of ersatz starlight. Most were no more than a string of auto-astrogation numbers, reminding them all of how thinly spread the Imperium was. Star systems occupied by humanity gained data screed that scrolled down automatically, detailing their worlds closely. Populations, exports, tithe grades, and all the other macro-grade information the Imperium's slow bureaucracy needed in order to function. The statistics in the screeds were from the top of a pyramid of data. Even so, all except the most general would be out of date. System orbital marks, stellar progression tracks, zone delimits, borders, highlighted phenomena, and important outposts cluttered the map further. It became busy. Still, for another second, the Space Marines looked upon a pristine map of humanity's empire in that sector, annotated with a bureaucrat's diligence. Order and purity were as much an illusion as the hololith of the void. A further flicker brought the watching warriors closer to the truth. Cogitators overlaid the progress of High Fleet Leviathan over all the busy data of the cartolith. A shadow was engulfing the stars, multiple tendrils extending along attack vectors from beneath the galactic plane. They moved in unison, closing like a slow-motion vidplay of some monstrous aquatic beast snaring its prey. Though at first regard the tendrils appeared separate, splinters in the parlance of the age, all led back to the unknowable totality of the hive mind. As the monster moved, the galaxy died. Beneath the slowly questing tentacles, star signifiers, imperial and non-imperial both, flashed an angry red and grayed out. "Behold, High Fleet Leviathan," said Commander Dante, his outflung arm encompassing the writhing tentacles. "It has been on this heading for decades, consuming all in its path. This simulation is sped up by a factor of several thousand. As you watch, you will see it consume world after world, although in reality these planet deaths were months or years apart. Its progress is slow by our standards. By some mechanism, the Tyranids are able to violate natural law and exceed the speed of light somewhat, but as far as we know, the fleets cannot traverse the warp. Over the last few decades, this has offered us a small strategic advantage, as we have been able to respond more quickly than it has. Nevertheless, I cannot claim any sort of victory. We have done our part in attempting to stop the High Fleet, but in doing so have discovered that it could not be stopped. It is too vast and growing bigger. Every world devoured has strengthened it in number and variety. Forgive me if I provide knowledge you already possess. There are several chapters here who have warred valiantly against the great devourer, but not all of you have." Dante paused. "We have fought Leviathan many times now, and we have come to new, disturbing conclusions." A smaller scale map sprang into being, separated from the greater in a glowing wireframe rectangle. It displayed two alternate courses for the High Fleet, one lighter than the other. "From the data we have gathered from the Ordo Astra, and which has been provided to us by the Inquisition and other adepta, we believe this darker course to have been Leviathan's original trajectory," said Dante. "See how it looked to be avoiding the Red Scar until this sharp turning to the galactic north 12 years ago. The Red Scar is a poisonous area of space. The High Fleets, as a rule, seem to be drawn to rich worlds, those populous or with intact natural systems. They favor sectors with high densities of such planets and avoid perilous areas of space. But in this case, The High Fleet appears to be foregoing richer sectors in favor of a strategic goal. We believe that it is actively seeking the destruction of the Blood Angels chapter. A hubbub arose at these words.
That is impossible, Commander Dante.
Lord Malthus, Chapter Master of the Exsanguinators, blurted the Herald Skull.
We have fought against these creatures before. They appear cunning, but they have as much self-determination as a colony of steel mites. They are animals. They do not bear grudges.
Tekiel, Chapter Master of the Disciples of Blood, said the Servo Skull.
Then why, 12 years ago, did Leviathan alter its course and begin to head directly for Baal? Said another.
The Skull's announcement went unheard, as voices clamored at Dante. Space Marines argued with each other.
My brothers, shouted Dante. Scaraban, the chief librarian of the Flesh Eaters, has invested a great deal of time into investigating this independently of our chapter. Listen to him. Then judge.
Scaraban left his seat and went through a gap in the table into the hololith at the center of the room. As he talked, he strode through the stars like a celestial being. His force staff glimmered with unearthly power, as if he could not quite separate himself from the warp.
We in the Imperium see the Tyranids as a collection of creatures linked together through psychic interface, he said. It is an understandable misconception. We compare the things we fight to other foes. In this case, comparisons begets false truths. There is nothing like this race of beasts in this galaxy, and therefore nothing to accurately compare them with. We face heaving masses of creatures and see armies of individuals. We observe the higher forms appearing to make decisions and directing the lesser, and see officers or slave masters. The Tyranids appear as a race like any other, one that has incorporated many species into its genetic memory and that employs radical gene engineering and psychic slavery. This is the logical interpretation. It is also wrong. The Tyranids are winning their war because the Imperium has been blind to their, or should I more correctly say, its true nature.
You know the truth of its being?
Chapter Master Geron of the Angels Numinous, said the Skull.
Its gravity motor growled with effort as it flew back and forth across the room.
I did not discover it, said Scaraban. This hypothesis is but one of several theories advanced, but it has the merit of being true. I have seen it.
Doubtful talk struck up.
No psyker can look into the shadow without going insane, Adeptus Astartes or not.
Suetona, fifth captain, Angels of Light.
I have, said Scaraban.
I hear rumors that you consort with decadent Eldari to further your knowledge, said Suetona hotly.
If I have, it is to the benefit of all, said Scaraban.
Eldari destroyed the third company of my chapter not 4 years ago. They cannot be trusted.
Silence, warned Dante.
So commanding was his voice, the brewing argument was quashed instantly.
There will be no dissent, no airing of grievances. Do not do the enemy's work for him. I have seen it too. Scaraban speaks the truth.
Mephiston rose from his chair. His eyes glowed blue, and on wings of scarlet energy, he flew over the heads of his peers and landed in the center of the map, his deathly pale skin lit by the dancing lights of disturbed hololithic star systems. Dark mutters greeted the Lord of Death's intervention.
I have looked into the shadow in the warp and seen the thing that casts it, said Mephiston. What assails our galaxy is not an army of individuals or even a colony of social animals working as one, but a single creature, a monstrous foe of inconceivable dimensions. Scaraban is correct. We have our perception of this predator back to front. It is not as it appears, a host of creatures linked psychically. It can instead be seen as a single massive psychic presence, a single mind. These monsters that attack us generate it. They make it as a man makes his soul, but whereas ours are individual, theirs is singular. A single predator, not many.
And when they attack each other,
said Malthus.
Perhaps the High Fleets are different beings, one mind for each, Perhaps they are all ultimately one. We cannot say for sure. The Tyranids are utterly alien. But we know the hive mind is real. This intelligence is emergent, coming from the billions of creatures in the swarms, but it is not an empty intellect. It is aware. It has a soul.
You say, then, this being is a warp entity born of the immaterium? Asked the librarian. In our Librarius, we have theorized it is but another thing of chaos wearing Xenos skin.
Codicea, Laetamos, brothers of the Red, the Herald Skull announced.
Scaraban shook his head.
I am sure its origins are in this realm of being. We are not alone in holding this opinion of its nature. The reports of Inquisitor Cryptman, others in the Inquisition, and the Magos biologists suggest so. At least those that support this interpretation. Perhaps what we are seeing is a creature part way to spiritual transcendence, a gestalt made of the minds of billions of brute animals trapped half in and half out of the warp by unending hunger.
You suggest we fight a god?
Scoffed a space marine of cadaverous appearance. His eyes were sunken in skin that looked dry as dust.
Carnifus, third captain, blood drinkers. Is there a better word for such a thing? Said Mephiston.
Blasphemy,
muttered Carnifus.
Then should we not take the flight to it psychically, destroy the mind, and the bodies will follow?
Damanes, seventh captain, brothers of the Red, said the Herald Skull.
We cannot fight it in the warp, my brothers. Its presence there is so overwhelming that the Emperor himself would not prevail, said Dante.
When these things are separated from their mind, as has happened in my wars against them, be it by psychic or physical means, they remain alive and savage, with a will and intelligence of their own to fall back on until they are enslaved again. The Leviathan must be killed in the flesh. Then the mind will die, for the mind is generated by the creatures it guides. It is a thing of this world that is half in the next. That is its weakness. Its creatures seem endless, but kill enough of them, and the hive mind is weakened. Kill all of them, and it is over.
But then it will not die until every last one of its vile spawn is destroyed.
Ares, ninth captain, red wings.
Dante waited for the echoes of the Servo Skull's announcement to end.
Then it shall be made to recoil, as the monsters of the night once fled before fire in mankind's primitive past.
Either it will flee, or it will die. As long as Baal survives, I care not.
My brothers, he said, the Red Scar is lifeless. With the Satis system lost, and all stocks of its elixirs exhausted, the Red Worlds are being abandoned. Without the Satyrix elixir, most are uninhabitable. Where this is yet to happen, I have taken action. Those worlds that the Tyranids have not stripped already are dead by my hand. They will find the Red Scar empty of all but ashes.
Dante's voice quietened. He regarded himself as the defender of humanity, ordering exterminatus on 40 inhabited worlds. Sat ill with him. Words of affirmation came from those captains and masters who had been on these missions.
The Tyranids will find nothing to sustain them, said Dante. If we stop them here, we can turn them back from the populous worlds to the north and east. If we drive them from the ramparts of the Arx Angelicum, we shall trap the Leviathan in the Red Scar, watch it starve, and destroy it at our leisure.
Deafening cheers erupted. Hands hammered on the table until it shook. When the applause subsided, Dante set out his plans. Chapter 11. Sealed in Blood. Gabriel Seth made his way along the lower walls of the Arx. Even among so many of Sanguinius's bloodline, there was no mistaking the chapter master of the Flesh Terrors. He was an immense man, taller than most space marines by a head. His blocky face, so set with anger, it appeared to be a study in fury carved from granite. To a mortal, he was a giant clad in brutal black and clotted red. To his bloodkin, he was a liability. A furious monster, more likely to kill his allies than aid them. Their reputation was not entirely deserved. Gabriel Seth was cursed with dark celebrity. Seth crossed the bone walk below the Sanguis Corpusculum in shadow, the sun being on the far side of the great tower. Polished skulls stared up at him from beneath a protective coating of transparisteel. He had the walk to himself. Few signs of Sanguinius had business on the walls, for all were busy with preparations for the coming war, as Seth himself would have been had Dante not summoned him. When they did venture to the heights, the upper levels of the Arx Murus were preferred by his cousins. The view from the lower terraces of the angelic host was poorer. Seth looked out at the host dismissively. Where some might see unbridled imperial might, he saw weakness. All the warriors suffered from the flaw like his own chapter did, yet in the main they denied what they were. They were not worthy to carry the blood of Sanguinius in their veins. A mournful cry from the Tower of Amareo seemed in agreement with his opinion. The empty sockets of the skulls watched him without sight. The eyes of passing servitors were just as blind in their own way, and the cyborgs went by without acknowledgement. Their reworked minds were too focused to fear him. Seth welcomed the opportunity to think, unbothered by the reactions of others to his presence. His own reputation had grown, but his chapter was still mistrusted by the other chapters of the Blood. Too many of them thought themselves above his brethren, and those that knew they were not were mired in their own misery. Only a handful of the sanguinary brotherhood were regarded with more caution than the flesh-tearers. Seth was untroubled. Their suspicion was justified, at least in part, for his chapter was savage. Service was its own comfort. He rebuffed sympathy as strongly as he did challenges to his authority. There was no salvation for his kind. There was only war, and wrath was a useful tool in its prosecution. Seth rounded the flank of the Sanguis Corpusculum into weakening sunlight. The ivory sides of the sanguinary tower shone pink as newly exposed bone. Another day was ending. Half of Baelor was lost behind the horizon. The silhouette of Baal Primus had taken a large bite of the part that remained. The last warriors of Seth's chapter were on the moon. He was annoyed at being called away from them at this delicate time of preparation. His place was at their side. After the betrayal on Nicaris and the attempt on his life from within the flesh-tearer's own ranks, some of his warriors still needed watching. Dante had requested his presence at the second landing column of the Sanguis Corpusculum. The site came into view, haloed by the sun, but the column and its landing pad were out of sight, retracted to the lowest position 100 feet below. When the pad was at its medium elevation, it was possible to walk from the bone walk onto the platform. When at the bottom of its range, there was a sheer, unguarded drop. Where the bone walk bent around the pad, turning into a concavity in the side of the tower, stood a sole sanguinary guard. Seth approached him. The warrior watched. They were so poised, the firstborn of Sanguinius. His own honor guard would have leapt forward like chained dogs in challenge. Seth weighed the prowess of the guard. There was much he could tell in how a warrior stood. He could have killed him, of course. The vision of himself doing just that flickered through his mind. A blow to the chest to disrupt power flow to the guard's jump back. A follow-up to the throat. It would not be enough, but it would be the start of a worthy challenge. His muscles tensed in anticipation of violence. Upon his stony face, there was no change. "Greetings, Master Seth," said the sanguinary guard. "Our Lord Dante speaks with sanguinary priest Albinus. He sends his apologies and bids you wait here with me." The guard's hand shifted on the hilt of his incarmine sword. Seth's lip curled dismissively. He wondered if the guard was one of those blood angels that hated his chapter. Dante tried to hide it from him, but the hatred many of his warriors held for the flesh-tearers was obvious and insulting. "Dante called for me," said Seth. "Be civil." His words were measured, imbued with a calm that he had spent a century perfecting. It was a crust upon seething lava. Always he was ready to unleash his fury. He took in all detail around him, noted every threat. At the far end of the walk was a second sanguinary guard. Another watched on from an aperture in the tower's side above. Something important was happening there. "I mean no offence, my lord," said the guard, and Seth thought perhaps he did not. "My brothers and I have been asked to detain you only until the commander is finished." "Then I will wait," said Seth. He spoke neutrally. He kept his pronouncements to the point in case they turned to unintended threat. The golden-armored guard inclined his head. "I thank you on behalf of Lord Dante for your understanding. Once again, I apologize for the delay." Seth glared a moment at the guard. The guard returned his stare, and Seth half smiled in acknowledgement of his bravery. Grunting dismissively, the flesh-tearer went to the edge of the bone walk to look down at the lowered pad. Light spilled from the open hangar of the sanguinary tower, the main part of the sanguis corpusculum, cross-hatching the long shadows teased out by the setting sun. Soft yellow light lay over pink. From his position, he could not see inside the complex. 10 scouts formed a cordon around a Thunderhawk gunship. The neophytes of the Blood Angels were force-grown to maturity in the space of a single year, and the young warriors had their full size and suit of gifts. Their black carapaces should not have been implanted, as it was the Blood Angels' custom to gift the carapace only at the close of training. In this single regard, they conformed with other chapters. Seth's enhanced sight saw scabbing on the scouts' fatigues, the marks of recent wounds which corresponded to the positions of neural interface ports, and rising from them, he scented surgical gels and blood heavy with Ladaran cells. He watched them like a lion waits outside the cave of primitive men. They were toys at his feet. He calculated the best way to jump down, the most efficient way of killing them. Sanguinius's wrath stirred in his breast, urging him to do it. As it tormented him, he taunted it in reply by his inaction. A trio of sanguinary priests and white-robed thralls stood to the side of the Thunderhawk's open prow ramp, a demi-squad of battle brothers at their backs. Commander Dante was speaking with them, although Seth could not hear what they said. A line of tracked servitors trundled up to the base of the Thunderhawk's rear ramp, as well-ordered as ants. They lowered gray pallets to the ground at the foot of the ramp, turned 180 degrees, and went away. Containers, covered in methylon frost, were removed from the pallets by blood thralls wearing insulated suits. From there, they carried the cargo on small grav sleds into the Thunderhawk's hold. The men went in and came out again. The servitors arrived and deposited their loads, two loops meeting, but never touching. He saw the relationship between his chapter and the Blood Angels described in their toil. Entities, worlds apart, yet derived from the same source, their endless labors to a common end. He snorted in harsh laughter at himself. Dante was getting to him. A tech marine dodged his way past the loaders and into the craft. Soon afterwards, the Thunderhawk's jet covers petaled open and began pre-flight testing, cycling up and down with whining roars. Heat haze shimmered around the exhaust. The servitors brought out the last of the containers. They drove away into the hangar and did not return. The last pallet was unloaded. Most of the thralls left and returned inside also. Dante reached out a hand and placed it on the lead priest's pauldron. Seth assumed this was Albinus. Seth could not see what Dante said to Albinus, but the sanguinary priest fell to his knees, clasped Dante's golden-clad hand, and pressed it to his lips with his head bowed. His men saluted and boarded the craft. Albinus got up, embraced his lord, took his helmet from a thrall, and followed his warriors into the hold of the Thunderhawk. A klaxon honked, drowning out the ambient noise of the host's preparations for war in the desert. Giant engines engaged under the landing pad. Ground crew unhooked fuel lines and ran into the hangar. Dante was left alone. He glanced upward and nodded at Seth. Like a giant piston, the landing pad rose. The klaxon blared all the way. When it drew level with the bone walk, Dante stepped off and came to stand by the master of the flesh tearers. The pad continued to grind upwards, rising over them until it was as high over Seth as it had been below him. Seth broke their mutual silence.
"You send away your gene seed."
"Yes," said Dante.
"You do not think you can win," said Seth bluntly.
Dante looked at him. or rather Sanguinius did, his golden face frozen forever in an outraged shout.
"I have seen Leviathan descend," said Seth. "That was no victory. You said so yourself. We nearly lost our lives at Cryptus. We will lose everything here."
Dante looked away, back to the landing pad. "There is hope," the Sanguinor himself told me. "I was like you, Seth. I despaired."
"Beyond wrath, there is only despair," said Seth. "Better to be wrathful."
"I choose to be hopeful. The Sanguinor has never spoken, not once in 10,000 years. At Cryptus, he did."
"Sending your gene seed away is not the act of a hopeful man."
"I am a pragmatist, Gabriel. Albinus is a loyal warrior. He will keep our future safe, even if our home is lost.
The scouts were newly implanted with a carapace,
prematurely elevated in case of need. They must prove themselves still, but when the time comes, they will be ready for their armor," said Dante.
"For what?" "We cannot win," said Seth, "and 10 scouts cannot rebuild the Blood Angels."
"Perhaps not," conceded Dante, "but this chapter has been reduced to a handful of warriors more than once. If we fail here, the Blood Angels will rise again on some other world." The Thunderhawk's engines, built to a blast furnace roar, spikes of white-hot flame stabbed out over the lip of the raised landing pad.
"What of it, then?" said Seth, suddenly angry. His jaw clenched so hard, he spoke through his teeth. "I bleed willingly for you, Dante, for one reason. Of all the puling men who claim descent from the great angel, you are the only honorable one. You understand what it is to feel the pull of the black rage. The others pretend. None but the flesh-tearers know the depths of fury. Wrath is what we are. It is what we all are. You have lived long enough to face it yourself."
"So," he shrugged, his fists closed involuntarily,
"if you choose to send your gene seed away, it is no business of mine."
"You would not do the same?"
"I never claimed to be able to save my chapter. It dwindles before my eyes until a bare few hundred remain. All I ever wished was for a glorious end in honor of the Emperor and the memory of Sanguinius. If we must be damned, then we will fall in the service of the Imperium by blood and fury, so it shall be. Best to end it here, if it must end."
"You would not unleash your legacy on this galaxy without your guidance. You would rather your chapter died?"
"If that is what you think, Dante, then believe it." "What do you want, Commander?" growled Seth. "The last time I was on Baal, I was brought as a prisoner to your Forum Judicium. I recall you saw no need to ask my permission. I am insulted that you ask the approval of these weaklings to command them."
"Seth, you seek outrage for the sake of it," said Dante. Some of his poise deserted him. He sounded tired. "You know it is different this time. You have proved yourself 1,000 times the loyal servant of the Imperium. You know it had to be done." Seth made a humorless noise.
"Tell that to the innocents fallen before our wrath. Tell that to my men who dared to oppose me."
"Your savagery is your strength as much as your curse."
"Savage? Here I am, obedient."
"If it rankles, why?" said Dante. Seth looked up at the darkening sky and the moving constellations of shiplights.
"Because I owe you a debt of honor that cannot be repaid. I have placed my men under your command many times. I have watched them die in pursuit of your goals. Remember this, Commander Dante," said Seth, and the furious expression on his face grew deeper. "I am not your thrall. Do not take my obedience for granted. You sent me to the moon of Baal Primus, and you called me back. I am here. What more do you want?"
Dante sighed disappointedly.
"Seth, Seth, Seth."
He shook his head. "Gabriel, I mean you no dishonor." "Quite the opposite, in fact," said Dante. "I did not call you here to witness the removal of our gene seed. Do you think I'm making some sort of point to you?" Seth shrugged. He honestly didn't care. The Thunderhawk lifted off. Landing gear clunked away, and it appeared over the pad edge, turning in the sky, nosing heavenward. Engines roaring, it pushed upward slowly, so blocky and huge it looked as if it could never break free of Baal's gravity, but as it rose, it accelerated, and tore away from the Arx Angelicum, leaving black contrails in its wake. "There, it has gone. One small mercy," said Dante.
"You save your chapter and sacrifice mine," said Seth.
"Do you think I would do that to you, Gabriel?" said Dante. The boom of a gunship breaking the sound barrier rumbled over the desert. The muted industry of the host took its place. The sun was sinking away. Bright light snapped on in the sands. The work proceeded around the clock. Deliberations in the council had lasted most of the previous night. Dante had spoken at length, assigning duties to the chapters of the blood. There was little dissent, but there were many generals almost as gifted as Dante, and some had expertise even the ancient chapter master lacked. His plans were refined by his peers. Out in the desert, tech marines from all across the Imperium labored side by side to raise new fortifications, armies of servitors at their beck and call. Dante sighed and reached up for his helmet. Sorrow troubled Seth's boundless, caged fury. He disliked Dante hiding behind the face of their Primarch, but once his helmet was free, he liked what he saw even less. Dante was old. That was what nobody ever expected to see behind that ageless, golden face. They thought him in the prime of his power, such was Dante's reputation, but men were not meant to live so long. And Dante, though exceptional, was no Primarch. Shadows pooled in his sunken eyes, a morbid foretaste of his appearance in death. "I did not call you here to insult you." "I have something for you, Gabriel," said Dante. "Please, come with me." Dante set out. Seth hesitated before following. They walked around the bone walk to where it joined a larger terrace lined with light artillery. All were covered over with tarpaulins, the stations empty of men or half-men. They followed the gallery to the main peak of the arcs, and there went into a small sally-port, unobserved. A dimly lit tunnel greeted them, so narrow Seth had to stoop. The shoulder pads of his brutal armor scraped on the stone. He growled. His pulse sang in his ears. He wanted to fight, not creep around in the dark. "We are nearly there," said Dante, sensing his rising ire. A second small door opened into a room, lit by a shaft of dark orange light shining through a single hole high up in the wall. As the sun sank, it crawled up the stone and would soon be extinguished. A solitary blood angel, his helm a veteran's gold, stood guard by a simple plinth. The plinth and the tall object on it were covered in black silken cloth, with a weave so close it was smooth as water. A tight grin pulled at Seth's mouth. This was made by an Adeptus Astartes. Where did the blood angels find the time to make such things? "Leave us," said Dante. The veteran departed with a wary glance at the flesh-tearer. As soon as the door was shut, Dante pulled the cloth away. It whispered off a long, beautifully crafted cylinder, a yard in length, made of gold that glowed softly in the darkening room. "Do you know what this is, Gabriel?"
"The reliquary of Amit," Seth said. "Inside, there is the last of Sanguinius's feathers. Any of the blood would recognize it."
Even Seth's dour heart was stirred by the sight. "Aye, and his blood," said Dante. He lifted his Terminatus honor from around his neck and pressed it into a concealed cavity in the cylinder. The reliquary hinged in half. Inside, a feather as long as Seth's arm hung suspended within the soft glow of a stasis field. Seth's breath caught in his throat. The feather was pure white. In the glow of the field, he could see every barbule. Around the base of the barbs were soft down of unimaginable delicacy. Below them, the shaft graduated from white to a delicate gray at the blunt tip. Its purity was marred around the top by crimson splatters, blood that gleamed, eternally wet. "This feather has never touched the ground. It was caught as it fell from our Lord's wing on the wall of the Imperial Palace as he fought there. and placed in this stasis field. Shortly after, he met his death at the hands of Horus. In all that time, the field has never been deactivated. Within the field, the time of Sanguinius's death has yet to occur.
Beauty birthed our wrath, said Seth quietly.
He could not reconcile the two. Beauty makes its home in you, Gabriel Seth. If you could wipe it free of blood, you would see the glory in you. Sanguinius writes of your founder Amit's savagery, but also that he was a great craftsman. Dante pointed at the casket. He made this container in penance for Sanguinius's death. True art speaks to the soul, but the greatest speaks from the soul. So much art is subjective, dependent on the observer and not the artist. The greatest art transcends this. It takes on a universal meaning. Its intent cannot be mistaken or interpreted. This is one of those rare pieces. One looks at Amit's reliquary, and we can feel his sorrow at the death of our Lord. It is an exquisite piece of work. Dante removed his Terminatus honor from the socket. The reliquary slid shut. Dante took it up. The shaft of sunlight had gone. The chamber had faded to a pinkish gray. Dante's bloodstone glowed in the gloom. Dante held the relic out to Seth. It belongs to you. Seth looked at the treasure in incredulity.
The feather? He said. I will not take this.
Dante held out the reliquary further. It belongs to your chapter. The spirit of your founder is rooted in its metal. That, more than the reliquary, has protected it. It is time it went home. Take it. Seth looked from golden cylinder to Dante's deadly serious face.
Then you think like me. You do not expect to win, said Seth.
We must win. There are uncountable foes arrayed against us, but with the chapters of the blood gathered here, we have a chance at victory. Even so, this fortress monastery could fall. The hive mind will attempt to destroy the Arx Angelicum. There are areas of our home that can bear such attentions without destruction, perhaps, but I have ordered that our most precious artifacts be removed and sent from this place. The scrolls of Sanguinius, our gene seed, and the other relics of our Lord. It seemed most fitting that you should take this reliquary and its contents in memory and honor of your founder. Dante stopped, considering his next words carefully.
You may refuse, of course, but I ask you to accept this burden in honor of our friendship. Friendship, Seth frowned. There is only fury and service. Brotherhood is the bond of blood, but not friends. Never friends.
Do you really believe that, Gabriel? Said Dante. I faced dissent from the Red Council for reaching out to your chapter. I maintain it was absolutely the correct action. You are among the most worthy men I've ever known. You struggle with the thirst and the rage, but you rise above it. You have no special gift, as does Mephiston. You are not damned like Clematis.
I am not as wise as you, said Seth.
Do you think that I am immune? Said Dante, deeply troubled.
I tell you I am not. You suffer more than I do, but you resist. I do not know if I could do the same.
I admire you. He took Seth's hand and placed it upon the reliquary. These relics do not belong to me. I cannot give them away, but it is in my power to see they are safeguarded in whatever way I see fit. I give this into your trust as a necessity. The feather inside bears the last unadulterated drops of blood other than that contained in this bloodstone. Dante pressed two fingers against the blood drop on the brow of his helmet. I give it to you as an honor for all you have done for my chapter. I give it to you in recognition of your skill and intellect. I know that should every last one of us die, you will somehow see this relic safe. But most of all, Gabriel Seth, I give you this feather and its casket as a friend. Seth hesitated.
You have changed, said Seth.
He sniffed the air.
I smell it on you.
Dante's head lowered. I took blood for the first time in a long time.
Ah, said Seth, you are not pure after all.
He intended to express bitter pleasure, but sadness overtook him. He realized then he needed Dante to be better than all of them. Seth took the reliquary.
I will take it. I swear it shall be safe by the blood and by the great angel and by the emperor.
Thank you, said Dante in relief. Tonight we feast. Tomorrow you will leave for Baal Primus. This may be the last opportunity you and I have to speak in private, Gabriel. I wish you good fortune. Seth hefted the reliquary thoughtfully. Before he could wish Dante good fortune in return, the door had opened, and the commander had gone. The lictor looked like a creature unto itself. It moved as a solitary organism. It had operated on its own for years, far away from the Hive fleet. But it was not apart from the Hive mind. That was the mistake the prey always made. Even at this corpuscular level, it was a mistake to see the lictor as a lictor, one of millions. There were not many. There was one. The lictor was the lictor. Every iteration was a copy, better than perfect for eons of improvement, party to the actions, mistakes, and successes of every other lictor that had come before. Welded to the very genes of its being were untold millions of years of experience. And it was on Baal, just as it was simultaneously on 1,000 other worlds throughout the galaxy. It put ancient lessons into action. Sight was the easiest sense to fool. The lictor moved at night, when it was harder to see. Chromatic microscales lent it near-perfect chameleonic ability, even in the full light of day. Deformable organ clusters embedded in its skin allowed it to change its shape somewhat, enabling it to take on the rough texture of stone or mimic fronds of vegetation. Smell was a more primal sense, harder to deceive because of it. The lictor managed that too. It had virtually no scent. Only when it flooded the air with pheromone trails to guide its kin beasts did its emissions become noticeable. By then it was too late. Most prey could hear, so it made no sound when it moved. Special arrangements of hairs baffled the whisper of its limbs moving over one another. More esoteric senses were equally well accounted for. Its electromagnetic profile was minimal. Its brain case was shielded by internal bone structures against energy leakage. The nerves in its body were similarly cloaked. Its hooves were shaped to make the minimum of vibration, and although it could not entirely stop the perturbation of the air made by its movements, its chitinous plates were fluted in precise molecular fractal patterns to minimize its wake. It gave off no heat. It shed no cells unless damaged. Its psychic link with a Hive mind was like spider silk, gossamer thin, strong, and almost impossible to detect. More adaptations heaped on top of more. Unlike a natural organism, which loses certain gifts in favor of others as evolution pushes it down a particular path, the lictor's advantages were retained, new gifts stacked atop the others. Its genetic structure was incredibly complex. Within every cell was billions of years' worth of adaptation, culled from every lictor, coiled up one over the other. Anything useful to its role, no matter how inconsequential seeming, it retained forever. Every machine and psychic ability the Imperium had geared towards detection, the lictor could evade. The Hive mind had consumed far more advanced races than mankind. Infiltrating Baal was child's play. There was no need for it to employ a fraction of its considerable talents. At night, it sprinted tirelessly across the desert, sustained by bladders of supernutritious food contained within its body. The roar of the Hive mind was growing stronger by the day, but the lictor was not aware of the mind. It had no sentience. Instead, the mind became aware of the lictor, much in the way a man becomes aware of his limbs only when he thinks of using them. On it pounded through the nights as the prey creature's clumsily engineered warrior caste gathered around the world. As Mephiston dreamed, it loped across the waste of Enod. As Dante drew up his plans, it crossed the Bloodwise Mounts, bounding tirelessly from crag to crag, its hooves punching sharp holes in the pristine snows of the summits. Where it could, it fed upon Baal's sparse life to supplement its nutrient fluids, but it did not tire. It stopped to avoid detection, never for rest. By the time Commander Dante called his Great Red Council to order, the lictor was skittering through the solidified lava fields of the Domitian Badlands. The prey was cunning. If other creatures like itself had made it to Baal, they had been found and destroyed, and it was a long time before it felt the sympathetic life pulses of other tyrannic organisms. One was all it took, for one was all, and all was one. Wherever there was a sole representative of the species, there was the hive mind. The final night of Leviathan's approach drew closer. The lictor burrowed into the crest of a towering dune as Baylor burst over the horizon and flooded the desert with ruby light. Its eyes peered through siftings of sand. Red day struck off a distant fortress, the black of its carved stone stark against the desert. Metal shell prey conveyances flew from the fortress into the great star sea and all around it were thousands of the prey warriors. A feeble number against the onrushing trillions. If the lictor could have, it would have felt contempt. But it did not. It could not. It saw a target, like a scope sees a target. It knew without thinking, without being, what it must do. Sophisticated senses appraised the fortress for weakness. It saw nothing it could use. Not yet. It needed more information. Burrowing deeper into the sand, the lictor settled in. To wait. Chapter 12. The Feast of the Damned. For one night, the chapters of the blood did not speak of the Tyranids. The Well of Angels was crammed with long tables arranged in a series of nested hexagons. The very center was occupied by a temporary dais, upon which sat Dante and his fellow chapter masters. Outside that sat the captains, scores of them, and the executive officers of the chapters. Then the sanguinary priests, who occupied a facet of a hexagon facing the chaplains. On the same table, occupying another side of the hexagon, were 100 librarians. Beyond them sat hundreds of tech marines and squad sergeants. Only past that did the many tiers of tables accommodating the battle brothers begin. Finally, bounding them all in a thin line, was a single tier of tables set aside for the chapter's most important mortal servants, astropaths, navigators, human shipmasters and officers, warrior serfs, logisticium illuminati, historitors, scholiasts, craftsmen, and the 100 more professions required to keep a chapter running. The tables so thoroughly filled the Well of Angels that the mortal table was set upon the first level of the Virtus Elysia. And so the human contingent looked down upon their transhuman masters. Viewed from on high in the volcano's shaft, the tables resembled an ancient angelic hierarchy, of which Dante, clad as always in his gleaming golden battle-plate, was the highest archangel of all. He sat upon a throne above the others. Now that the voting was done, Erwin supposed he wished to show his authority. In one place, the table's circuit was broken. A circular hollow was set into the floor there. Ordinarily, it held a small lake, but it had been drained, revealing a deep fighting pit floored with washed sand. There would be dueling to follow the feasting. The difficulties in provisioning the feast stretched the capabilities of a Blood Angel's logisticium. Brother Adonisio's serfs, used to feeding a few thousand mouths, were suddenly presented with 10 times more. The blood thralls worked tirelessly. Servants of every rank volunteered to fill lowly serving roles, as the success of the feast and the reputation of their master's chapter meant a great deal to them. Men, used to governing cities, passed between the rows of tables bearing heavy platters and trays, weighty with wine, for the honor of it. Vat creatures and cybernetic slaves flew overhead. Plumes of heavy blue incense smoke poured from censers carried by some, while others played heavenly music that shifted and changed according to the mood of the crowd. "This is an exceptional vintage," said Erwin, sipping his wine. A medley of flavors teased his palate, enriched with a few drops of fresh, expertly spiced blood, and just enough vitae to sate the thirst without provoking it further. His dinner mate was a captain of the Angel Sanguine named Bolthus. He drained his cup.
"You speak the truth, brother. We have nothing like this. The soils of our world are too bitter to bear such fine fruits."
Erwin nodded. "Most are. We are a void chapter. Our opportunities for agriculture are narrow. Still, we can thank the efforts of the Blood Angels for such excellent food. They are paragons in all things."
"Is that irony, brother captain?"
said the warrior to his right, a captain of the Sable Brotherhood. He was a lugubrious character who reminded Erwin more than a little of Ackerman. His name was Goss. Goss pushed his goblet forward with outstretched fingers. The eyes of a servo skull floating nearby flickered. A moment later, a serf appeared to replenish the drink.
"They say Dante emptied his cellars," said Bolthus appreciatively.
"Is that so?" said Erwin.
"I would, too, were I in his position. I heard a rumor he sent away his gene seed," said Goss.
He sat up straighter.
"And what of it?"
said Bolthus.
"We might not win," Goss said.
"Ill fortune to speak so,"
said Bolthus.
"Victory is never assured," said Erwin. "It must be fought for with cunning and great strength. Leave thoughts of defeat our heresy to the Astra Militarum. We're above that. We have to be. If we cannot countenance defeat, how can we find our way to victory?"
Erwin looked around, his curiosity piqued by the diversity of men who staffed his brother chapters. As a last symbol of peace, although Erwin thought it more to save space, Dante had ordered that they attend in their day robes. These were almost as varied as their wearers. Among the scions of Sanguinius, there were all manner of skin tones, variations in height and eye color, but all of them unmistakably bore the marks of their gene sire. Even those brothers whose basic physiology was markedly different had been changed by their gene seed, their faces re-sculpted to echo the thousands of images of Sanguinius that filled the Arx Angelicum. They resembled each other in a fundamental way that simply sharing kinship could not explain. He looked upon myriad variations of Sanguinius's face. Some chapters were more heavily touched than others, so that all their battle brothers looked as if they'd been stamped out of a mold. The only real differences were evident in expressions of the flaw. Some chapters appeared to suffer more than others. Those most heavily cursed were either dour at their predicament or straining with rage they could only just contain. There were a few chapters in this latter category who hid it better than others, the flesh tearers being one, but they betrayed their tension in their body language and manners. Some bore the first signs of genuine deviancy. There were warriors with bulging, bloodshot eyes,